The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Okay, so I'd like to thank everybody for coming tonight. Dr. Pelkowitz is somebody who needs no introduction in terms of his ability of giving this speech, but however, I'm sure we have to make note that he deserves a mention of that we have to have a lot of gratitude towards him. He, at any call that the school makes or the community makes for any need, he's always offering to help us and the whole class. So I'd like to thank you, Dr. Pelkowitz, and please come.
Thank you so much, Jesse. Okay. So what I'd like to do is, I'd love to get a discussion going. So let me talk for, I'll talk for a little bit, I'd love to really hear what's on people's minds. So what do you say? Let's have a vote. How long should I talk for? What do you say? Nobody's going to volunteer, right? Jesse, you're the...
I trust your judgment of the crowd.
Okay. Actually, I think this is probably calls for. Let me try to do like 20 minutes or so, just in terms of some basic stuff, and then we'll get going into real tachlis stuff. What I was asked to speak about is. The topic is identifying depression in your kid, in your adolescent, I guess even in yourselves. Why is this so important? It's important because it really, the earlier you identify something, especially like depression, the better chance you have of being able to stop it from declining into a repetitive kind of cycle. So we know that the eye sees only what it knows. If you learn to identify it earlier on, the chances of it sort of changing your whole brain structure and deteriorating into recurring episodes of multiple depression are diminished. The eye sees only what it knows. Some of you have heard me say this before, but it's worth saying. My Rebbe, Rav Palm, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, used to say that we have to keep our eyes open to that which is unpleasant. He said, especially if we see a child or an adolescent in some way suffering, and we choose not to act on it, and we choose not to recognize it, among the many problems with doing that from a Jewish standpoint, from a halachic standpoint, is you're over on halama. You're over on the hisalamta mayhem, on looking the other way. We see somebody struggling, we have to keep our eyes open to it. And like the end of that pasuk says, hakem takem imo. We have to stand by those who are suffering, especially when it comes to children and adolescents who aren't as likely to deal with it themselves. Let me just get through the basic stuff, okay? The basic stuff, which is maybe four or five basic points. Point number one is depression with a capital D is misleading, because we're used to thinking about it. Those of us who have never had to suffer with this illness are used to thinking of it as something like when we feel sad, or like when we feel depressed with a small d. So depression with a small d would be feeling blue, down in the dumps, a little hopeless and helpless. Everybody at some point in their lives, or maybe even at some point in their week, could feel a little down. You know, you could come back from a holiday weekend and get up early this morning to have to go to work, and you may feel a little frustrated. You may feel a little bit more likely to be pulled into depression when you hit some traffic on the Van Wyck Expressway. But that's not what I'm talking about. When we talk about depression with the capital D, it's qualitatively different. It's only similar to a passing blue mood in the most superficial of ways. One of the things I always used to teach our psychiatry residents or our psychology graduate students was, if two people are wearing a tuxedo, it doesn't mean they're both going to a wedding. You could be wearing a tuxedo and it might mean you're going to a bar mitzvah, Or you could be wearing a tuxedo and it means that you're going to a wedding, or it might mean that you're a parking valet in some garage. It could mean very different things, the same external manifestation. Depression with a capital D is basically a difficulty in three areas. It's alterations in terms of body alterations, mood alterations, and cognitive alterations. So body alterations might be the problems with sleep that go beyond the regular problems with sleep that most adolescents are all about. It may either show itself like Yonah B'mehadaga in terms of sleeping nonstop day after day after day, or it may show itself with tremendous difficulty falling asleep and all kinds of alterations in sleep patterns. It may show itself with appetite disturbances at either end. It may show itself with fatigue, feeling like you're walking through water, being slowed down. Now, if you have that for just a little while, it's no big deal. But if you have a sustained alteration in those areas for a couple of weeks at a time, right away it goes from yellow flag to red flag. The other two global areas are mood. And what we mean by that is alterations in terms of the way it usually shows itself in adolescence isn't just with a down, dark mood of feeling depressed. It's also being irritable, which makes them difficult and has them push us away. There was a professor of child psychiatry at UCLA who used to say that child behavior problems come in two flavors, garlic and onion. Garlic is the kids whose behavior problems are they're always pushing other people away. Onion is where they themselves are miserable. In adolescence, depression is more of an everything bagel. It's a mixture of garlic and onion. So they may be the onion of being down in the dumps, but there's also often a garlic component, an irritability component, that makes them difficult to see past it. I just had a kid in my office early this morning who I was just thinking about this because I knew I was going to be addressing you tonight. I was thinking about how when he was referred to me, even though he's horribly, horribly depressed, his teachers, his rebbeim, his rabbi, his parents were talking about him in a way that made it clear to me that they don't like him very much. And as I met with him, I saw he's not that easy to like because the way he shows his pain is to be difficult. The way he shows his pain is to push others away with a cynicism and an irritability, but underneath it is a tremendous amount of pain. So in terms of the mood part of the triad, it's irritability, it's sadness, it's also anhedonia. Anhedonia means difficulty having pleasure. You know, the kids who you ask, well, what do you love doing? And they say, whatever. Now, a lot of kids do that for a living at both childhood and adolescence. But anhedonia is where you have a kid that you ask them, what do you enjoy? And literally, they can't squeeze out a single example of something that gives them pleasure. And you can imagine how crippling that would be, especially in children and adolescents. And finally, we have the cognitive stuff. What does it do to our thoughts? Okay, what it does to our thoughts is people who are depressed feel lousy about themselves. They have very pessimistic views of the future. They have very pessimistic views of the world. They see the glass of water as half empty rather than half full. And it makes them not much fun to be around. So to summarize, all the depression is a combination in some way of those three sets of alterations. Alterations in the body, alterations in mood, and alterations in cognitions. And when you have that in a sustained way, so that it's there more often than not for a couple of weeks on end, right away every parent should have a red flag go off. That's not what adolescents are about. It's not what normal adolescents are about. Does it mean that, God forbid, they have a horrible problem? No. Depression is very treatable. But if you have it, it's something that you need to keep your eyes open to. Hakeim takeim mimo. You have to stand behind them and be there for them. Now that I gave you basic words of introduction, let me just quickly review for you something that psychologists called masked depression. Masked depression is depression that doesn't show itself necessarily by a kid saying that they feel miserable. It may show itself in indirect ways. So, for example, it might be a kid who has a lot of aches and pains, stomach aches, headaches of unknown origin. You have a $1 million workup, the doctors can't figure out what it is. The body keeps the score, and sometimes depression shows itself with those vague aches and pains and with the, what psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers call somatic complaints. And then the other way that mass depression could show itself could be with behavior problems, externalizing problems. Okay, so that's the basic introduction in terms of what it is. Now, how do we know that there is risk? Let's talk a little bit before we get into the discussion about risk. What do we know about risk? What we know about risk is that there's a pattern that will sometimes show itself before a kid will present with ongoing depression. The pattern is certain kinds of personality vulnerabilities. It doesn't mean that a kid who has this is destined to be depressed, but it's part of the package in terms of your cognitive map of what's going on. One is you may have a kid who, even without being depressed, from early childhood on, they're just negative. This is a biologic thing. It's what they're about. They're always grumpy. They're always negative. They're always sort of like looking at the glass of water as half empty. There's a more of a disposition. You take them to great adventures, and they're the ones who are always having a miserable time and are irritable and maybe want to go home right away, even though they were excited about it beforehand. It might be the kid who's much more likely to just complain when other kids are excited about the very same event. In girls, this style is more likely to present itself with shy, withdrawn behavior where they may have few friends. That may be a childhood marker for risk. In boys, it's more likely to show itself with the garlic of under-controlled behavior. Okay, that alone isn't enough. Okay, so I just laid out basically, what are the three categories that comprise depression with a capital D? How do we know that it's different than depression with a small D? But what I wanted to talk about before we get into discussion is a little bit about how this shows itself in terms of, A, why is it so important to diagnose? And B, a little bit about what we know about prevention. So let me talk about it just for a few minutes, and then we could go into talking about other stuff. I have a feeling everything will come up in discussion anyway. Why is it so important to talk about? So important to talk about because on average, undiagnosed depression in an adolescent, for example, within 4 years, they are likely going to be self-medicating by taking drugs or doing alcohol. They self-medicate, okay? So they're having the intense pain of being depressed. They're likely to turn to some kind of substance to feel better. People do drugs or do alcohol either to feel good or to feel better. So there are some kids who just do it to feel good. It's what they're about. They're novelty seekers. They're always after the newer, better way of feeling good, and they love experiencing new kinds of stuff. But then there's the subset of adolescents who turn to drugs as their own personal version of Prozac or Zoloft. They're doing it to feel better. And those are the kids that we're talking about who are really at risk for having the very volatile mixture of the disinhibiting effects of alcohol or drugs coupled with the horrible experience of depression. And those two make for a volatile mix that could put somebody at risk for suicidal behavior, it could put somebody at risk for all kinds of difficulties in life. So again, what's sad about this is it's all very treatable. With the right kind of treatment, and the right kind of help, there is every reason to believe that kids are resilient. For the most part, kids who are able to get help, and where that help especially is given in the context of a loving family environment and a loving school and a loving neighborhood, there's every reason to believe that the norm is resilience. The problem is when you don't have that protective shield, when you don't have that safety net, then it could become a much more serious kind of problem. Let me end with a story, and then I really want to get a discussion going, because I want to know what's on your heads. I know there have been tragedies in the neighborhood in the last couple of weeks. I know that's why we're here, and I want to be able to talk about any questions you have in terms of how to reach out to your kids. Okay, obviously I have no right, nor do I have the ability to talk about specific situations, but let me end with the story. I was giving a talk at a homeless conference a little over a year ago. By the way, homeless conference, I was expecting that I'd go and I'd go to a parking lot and you'd have a lot of homeless people and I'd give a talk outside. And I was surprised. I was shown into this beautiful hotel ballroom. And the other speaker, the keynote speaker, was this guy who's like a real big shot. It was a big conference. It was a national conference on meeting the emotional needs of the homeless. And the other speaker was the guy who's like the homeless czar for the country. Okay? Very important guy, like almost an undersecretary level position where he's in charge of homeless policy for the entire United States. He has a PhD, he's won all kinds of awards. He's a big guy, big important guy. And I didn't know anything about him. And I nearly fainted when he told his story. I'm sitting up there, and here's the story that he tells. He says that when he was 13 years old, he was living as an only child in a home with horrible, horrible tsaros. And one day, and you'll forgive me for the graphicness of this, his father, in a coked-up rage, not even knowing what he was doing, in front of him, killed his mother and then killed himself. He's 13 years old, and he's left without his parents. He sees this horrible situation. He's a bright kid. And he tells the audience that he didn't want to fall into the hands of the foster care system, so he ran away. And he drifted from shelter to shelter in that part of the country, in the Midwest, just avoiding detection. He'd stay for a couple of days in one shelter. When he thought they were on to him, he'd run away, go to another shelter. He said he did this for 2 years, totally living a meaningless life, just drifting. Little kid. It's not what 13-year-olds are designed to do. He said until one day he heard four words that changed his life. The four words that changed his life were, "How are you doing?" What do you mean, "How are you doing?" He said it wasn't the words. It was the way the man said it. The director of a shelter looks in his eye when he comes in, puts his arm around him and says, "Oh, how are you doing?" And he saw in the nonverbal language that here's a man who really wanted to know. He really meant it. It wasn't just one of these, you know, slap you on the back, you know, nice to see how you doing, let's walk away. He really wanted to know. And something in his heart told him to let this guy know, so he told him. And he told the man, and the man really wanted to know. The director of the shelter heard and listened and heard the horrible story of this boy's life and the way he had been drifting for years and the way he was raising himself by drifting from shelter to shelter. And the man befriends him. The director of the shelter befriends him and takes him in and realizes that he's brilliant. It's a wasted mind. And he gets him a scholarship to a fine private high school, which in turn gets him a scholarship to an Ivy League college, which leads to his doctorate and his incredibly successful career. And he turns to the audience, he says, "You know something? If it wasn't for those four words, it never would have happened." And that's the message I want to leave with. Look, there's a lot of tsaros out there, and we can't fix everything. And a lot of times mental illness is, it really is predominantly biologically driven. But what all the research shows is that even illnesses as clearly biochemical in nature as depression or other kinds of psychiatric illness, the power of the outstretched hand, the power of giving somebody a figurative hug and really listening to them, right? The word ozen has the same etymology as the word maznayim, scale. Something very balancing about hearing people. Something very balancing about listening to them. And as long as we're there for each other as a community, that's why I'm so impressed. I didn't expect there to be much of a crowd tonight at all. And people really came. I know it's not easy. It's It's what, Erev Shavuos? What, it's Tuesday night? Yeah, it's Erev, right? Ooh, that's scary. Sorry, women. I'll let you. Let's try to end this in time for you to go back. So let's get some discussion going. And I will assume that you're talking about your next door neighbor. Okay? So let's hear about your neighbors. Or any questions, thoughts, comments? Yes, please. I'll repeat the question.
How does a person know the difference? Well, I guess a psychologist knows it, but how do you know the difference between somebody who needs that outstretched arm and how you're doing, and the person who needs medication?
Oh, okay. So the question is, how do you know when all somebody needs is a little bit of social support and a little bit of a hug, and somebody who really needs professional help? Okay? Now, the treatment of choice for full-blown depression, most people would say, is a combination. I don't think many people say that it's only medication. And if it's a full-blown depression, most people would agree that you probably do need to consider medication. The research shows the two together work best. How do you know when it crosses the line into clearly needing medicine? I mean, the simplest thing would be is if after giving support and after, you know, connecting the person to something, if they still seem to have the difficulties in those three areas, and it doesn't have to be the full-blown difficulties, if they still seem to have trouble with their mood, if they still seem to have trouble enjoying themselves, if they still seem to be slowed down in particular in terms of appetite or sleep or any of the symptoms that I described, that's probably a sign. At the very least, you get a consultation about medication. Now, medication alone probably doesn't do it. Pills don't equal skills, as we'd always drum into the heads of our psychiatry residents, okay? They also may need social skills. They may have problems in that area, and they also may need coping mechanisms to help them with the stresses of their lives. Very often, serious depression is embedded in an environment, either a family environment or a peer environment, that's not so easy to deal with. So, it's best to get the full package. But if a person doesn't respond pretty quickly to your support, it probably means you have to keep your eyes open to the need for medication. And the best thing you could do for a person like that is to gently get them to a consultation. If they won't go to a psychiatrist, most prescriptions for antidepressants are by pediatricians and internists. So it doesn't have to be necessarily through psychiatric channels. It may be just enough to start it by doing it through purely medical channels. Okay, thank you. Yes? Okay, so psychotherapy, according to the research, psychotherapy is probably every bit as important as medication. So certain kinds of psychotherapy in particular, there are two kinds of psychotherapy that are known to help with depression. One is a psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy that's based on helping the person systematically get control of the thoughts that are making them feel depressed and to systematically learn how to replace those with more adaptive kind of thoughts. It's based on the Baal Shem Tov, B'makom Shemachshavto Shel Adam Shem Hu Ha'ish. You could look out on a day like today and say what a beautiful early summer morning it is. You know, look at the trees, listen to the birds. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We're about to have a 2.5-day week. What could be nicer, right? We had Memorial Day off. We're getting Thursday, Friday. We're getting Friday. Well, not, I guess I'm in academia now. It's one big holiday. I guess you have to work on Erev Yontif, many of you. But anyway, so we're about to, you know, so you can look outside and look at and see things as unbelievably wonderful. Or you can look outside on a day like today and say, I have to get up. I've been sleeping late until now. I've been going to late minyan. And then you say to yourself, and it's very muggy outside, and I think it's mosquito season, and who needs this? And I have to be with relatives all yuntif. And you could talk yourself by allowing your thoughts to run amok into getting yourself more and more depressed. So what cognitive behavioral therapy does is it disciplines you to change your machshavos to be ones that are more associated with being positive. The other piece of therapy that's been shown to be very helpful is something very simple. It's called activity planning. You take the person who's depressed, and the research shows that as powerful as medication, if you add to it activity planning, having them find one pleasurable thing to do every day and one thing to do every day that gives them mastery, it's enormously powerful. And then the other kind of therapy that's been found to be very effective is something called interpersonal psychotherapy, which helps people improve their ability to connect to others. It helps them with their social relationships. And what many therapists do nowadays is they give you a toolbox. So they work on the thoughts, they work on the social, they work on the activities, they work on the whole package. And with that combination, you often can get incredible results. Incredible results. Is it guaranteed? No, it's not guaranteed. But to the extent that depression is the common cold of mental health, and that there are wonderful outcomes, especially when you get somebody young enough, there's every reason to hope that the normal reaction to a combination of the psychotherapy and the medication is for things to get better. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, what about prevention? Are there systems in place? Listen to this statistic. Okay, the optimal timing for prevention programs is thought to be school-based programs between the ages of 13 and 14, exactly like you say, at middle school level, because there's a sharp upturn of onset of major depression starting in the ages between 15 and 18, between the sophomore and senior year of high school. So the time to get them for prevention is middle school. That's ideal. Are there effective programs? Yes. As an example, there's a program that comes out of Penn, University of Pennsylvania, run by Dr. Seligman. It was actually I had the pleasure of having gone to graduate school there. And they have one of the most respected programs. It's called the Penn Prevention Program. They move into middle schools. They screen every kid to see who's at risk for depression. And they then teach the parents and teach the child how to think differently and relate to things differently very quickly, without therapy, just with some simple skills. The book that describes that is called The Optimistic Child. And it's written by Martin Seligman, S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N. Any of you who have a child who has that kind of gloomy, difficult, irritable personality, I'd highly recommend the book. It explains exactly how to implement cognitive behavioral kinds of interventions with your own child. And it teaches you how to work on yourself. And it's been found to greatly reduce the onset of depression in kids who are most at risk for it. There are other programs. There are suicide prevention programs that are thought to be fairly effective, both middle school and high school based, mostly teaching kids how to identify other kids who might have risk. So kids who might be depressed, kids who might be into drugs, and how to reach out to them, and how to realize that that's not ratting them out, but rather is just a way of taking care of them. So I'm getting to that. Yeah, no, that's okay. So those are the basic ideas. In terms of teaching the teachers, the same techniques, for example, that are used in the Penn Prevention Projects can be used to teach teachers. The problem is, most teachers don't get it. The reason I left my job at North Shore Hospital, I was very happy and was sold by Richard Scholl on leaving to go to teach in the Smicha program at YU and at Azrieli, was because of that promise that we're now teaching teachers and we're teaching future rabbis how to identify this stuff, how to intervene, and some basic ways. Again, the eye sees only what it knows. So now we're hopefully graduating a new generation of teachers who will at least know what to look for and know how to identify it. So a good graduate program, a well-trained teacher should know how to find this, and they should know when to refer, and they should also know how to create an environment in the classroom that's conducive to making, making the risks for depression even less. There are in-service education programs for teachers. I don't know if there are enough. I don't know that the average teacher is taught some of this stuff. But there's a revolution out there in psychology where we're learning more and more about how to prevent serious problems in adolescents and how to prevent serious problems in middle school age kids. And I'm just hoping that our community uses that. It's out there. I recently gave a series of talks in Yerushalayim, and there were hundreds and hundreds of educators who were very thirstily sort of reviewing. We reviewed together the various prevention projects that are out there. They're wonderful prevention projects. Prevention projects for anorexia, prevention projects for depression, prevention kind of interventions that are school-based for a whole host of other difficulties like drug abuse. And we know what works. Not everything works completely, but there are evidence-based programs that really do make things better. So, it doesn't take that intensive training for teachers. I just hope we do it. Unfortunately, we sometimes don't do enough in terms of providing the in-service training for teachers that they deserve and that our children deserve. So that's a very, very important point. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, that's another excellent question, is how often are these hidden? And some kids who are depressed will only look depressed to certain part of their lives and not another part of their lives. And that's something to really think about. And it's actually quite poignant sometimes. Very often, parents don't know. They protect their parents, especially if they think their parents are overburdened with other problems. So very often, the only ones who know may be one or two friends who the kid is opening up to. And very often, the kid's in this very intense, exquisite pain, and nobody knows. The way to know is to reach out to them, to ask them how they're doing, to spend time with them, and to connect to them. But if we're too overburdened, the research shows is that very often, the parents are not aware of it, because it's an invisible kind of pain very often. And sometimes it's like you're saying, sometimes the parents know and the child puts on a good show for everybody else. So they may be looking perfectionistic and very sort of like put together to everybody, and they don't know until you spend a little bit of time with them talking to them about how miserable they are, because it's an invisible illness. So it can definitely show itself that way with all kinds of combinations. And the best antidote I know to that is check in with your kid about how they're doing. And if they seem to be showing a change from their normal self, and they seem to be glumming down in the dumps, now some of that goes with adolescence, but not in a sustained way. So ask, talk, keep your eyes open. Yes?
There's a story that a woman told to Rob, says that my husband became sugar, he dances with shiksas, and eats chazer. So the Rob said, if you would be eating shiksas and dancing with chazerim, then he became a sugar. Now he's just not interested in being from anymore. So
Okay. So the question is, which is a very difficult question and a very hard question to answer al regalachas, the question is how do you know whether or not what the kid needs is the limits and the toughness, or the kid needs the love, right? Chazal tell us, as many of you have heard in other settings, that in dealing with children, we have to find the balance between smol dochev imimakarevis, right? We have to find the balance between simultaneously pushing away with the left hand while bringing closer with the right hand. And that's what psychologists tell us also. We have to find that balance. So Rav Simcha Wasserman, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, used to say, what happens if you take a child and you have the child facing you and you put into play what the Gemara tells us, and you simultaneously push them away with your left hand while bringing them closer with your right hand, you turn them around. You turn them around. Now, with that said, I don't think there is any at-risk rebellious kid who is happy being that way. deep down. When I sit with them and when I get to hear what's really in their hearts, they're miserable. I heard this from a colleague. It was recently I saw it picked up in an article in the Jewish press about this, where they asked a group of kids who were at risk, if somebody could give you a pill tonight and it would make it so that tomorrow morning you could wake up and be like everybody else with the same rules and the same life as everybody else, including the same restrictions, what would you do? And in a heartbeat, all the kids said, absolutely, I take the pill. And that's been my reality. My reality is they all need the Yemim HaKarevis. The reality also is they all need the Smol Docha. They all need both. The art of dealing with these kids is how to find that balance. It's how to find the balance. The Chazal tell us, the psychologists tell us. That's very difficult. But I don't find that we get very far with the pure Smol Docha of tough love. I don't find that. And I find that it's even more dangerous to have the pure Yemim HaKareves of always being there. But I'll tell you in the long run, and again, I don't have the answers to this any better than you do. I'll tell you in the long run that what I've seen over and over again is that as long as they continue to have a place in our heart, the vast majority eventually come back. I heard a story recently from a mother whose kid came back from after years and years of having totally left everything. And when she was asked, what led to his coming back? What's your theory? How did you do it? What's the magic? She answered, I never stopped holding his hand. Never stopped holding his hand. And that's what I find. That's what I find is what my colleagues find, that as long as there's some way to hold on to them, they eventually, with God's help, come back. They put us through a ringer until then. And we can't just do the hand without also doing the left hand pushing away. I know we need both. Finding that balance is something that very often parents with professional help are able to do and schools are able to do, but it's not so easy. Let me tell you one other quick story. It's not such a beautiful story. It's an eye-opening story. Story about a principal of a high school in Eretz Yisrael a number of years ago, had an at-risk kid, out-of-control kid, having terrible influence on everybody else in the yeshiva. So he goes to Rav Shach, and Rav Shach tells him he's a rodef, kick him out of the yeshiva, get rid of him. Can't, he's destroying everybody else. No question whatsoever, put him out. About 6 months later, the same principal had to go and ask Rav Shach another shiloh. And he goes to Panovich, and he's kept waiting outside for an inordinately long period of time. And he's waiting, and he's waiting, and he's waiting. And finally, out of Rav Shach's office comes Rav Shach and the boy who was kicked out of his yeshiva, and the boy's holding a gemara under his arm, Rav Shach's holding a gemara under his arm, and his other arm is around the boy. Principal asks, what happened? What's happening here? And Rav Shach looks at him and says, look, somebody had to learn with them. Okay? That's it. That's the balance. That's the left-right balance. So you're right. How do we know? I think always, like Chazal tell us, it's incredible wisdom in those few short words that I think are three times in Shas, or at least two that I could think of. Okay? Tremendous wisdom, and it's interesting. Research just coming out now is showing it to be so, that we don't need that research, but I'm telling you, it's there. It's there. The art of when is very, very difficult. It's very difficult. I wish I had exactly the right numbers on how to titrate it out, but it's kashem shem partsufo sein shava kachem deo sein shava. Every family has different perspective and different needs. So it's very, very, very tough balance. Yes.
Speak, you know, give brushes, and even
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And the point is, which is a very important point, is we are a generation of right-hand specialists. We're a generation that I think excels in loving our children, and we don't excel so much in limiting. I can't tell you how many times I've given parenting talks in different parts of this country, Europe, or Israel. And the number one questions have to do with limit setting, and the number one concern has to do with limit setting. And the research is chilling. The research is that it's much harder for parents to put the limits down on their kids. They're having a much harder time doing it. They really are. And I have parents come and wait to talk to me after a talk, and they'll almost cry to me, and they'll say, you know, how could I put limits on my kids? I don't put limits on myself. Or when I was that age, I was partying and experimenting with this or that. How could I be a hypocrite and tell them that they can't do the same thing? I have, in general, we have a generation that is having a particularly hard time facing pain in their children, when part of childhood and part of adolescence is the need to face pain. Some of you have heard me say this. I'll make the two very important points again. Number one, I've had three times in my career, at least, maybe four, adolescents who 15, 20 years ago were in my office going crazy as their parents put limits on them, screaming and yelling and going nuts to the point that they would say, you know, I'm the only kid in the whole neighborhood who has to be in, you know, on a weekday night. I'm the only kid who doesn't have a credit card. I'm the only kid who, you know, crazy kinds of complaints. And then when those adolescents had their own children, which happened to me three times, the same story, and they brought their children in to see me for other problems, they tell me, you know something, remember years ago I was going crazy in your office with my parents' rules? Deep down, I was so happy that they were not letting me do what I wanted to do. And you have to remember that. And that's the beautiful insight of a medrash. And the way this medrash falls on our ears in such an alien way, I think says a lot. Listen to the medrash. Goes on a pasuk in Mishle that says, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva ve'el hamiso al titei nafshecha. Says, put limits on your kids. There's always hope. And don't pay attention to their yelling, their screaming, their criticism. Don't pay attention to it. So listen to this unbelievable medrash. And listen to it with your Western ears, okay? My Western ears, because I couldn't believe it when I saw it. It says the following. Medrash on this pasuk says, Kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, mosif haben ahava al aviv. Unbelievable, right? The more a parent puts limits on his child, the more that child will love his parent. Isn't that really what it's about? And it's so true. Now, you have to do it with seichel. You have to do it in the context, rules with that relationship equals rebellion. You have to do it in the context of a good relationship. You have to do it in the context of the hug of the right hand, you know, and the hug of their knowing that they love you. You've heard me say this before. Some people have pointed out to me, you ever notice how you look sideways at your adolescent kid, they go nuts on you. They go nuts on you. But why is it that those of you who send your kids to schools that have sports teams, hockey teams, basketball teams, the coach could run them ragged. The coach could have the kids run, you know, 100 laps and do 50 push-ups, and the kids don't bat an eyelash. And the answer is because the kid knows that the coach is on his same team. Okay, that's the key. Kids will take the limits better if it's in the context of the hug, if it's in the context of the love. Now, I know this, you're right. You're right. I mean, it's one thing to talk about. It's the how to do it is very hard for a teacher where the kid is, I have some pretty alarming statistics on limit setting. Do you know that 8 out of 10 teachers complain in the United States in a survey done about a year ago, they complain that at some point one of their students threatened to sue them for putting limits on them, okay? One out of three teachers has seriously considered quitting the teaching profession because they're so upset with the level of disrespect they experience at the hands of their students. Now, hopefully our world is a little bit better, but from what you're hinting at, it sounds like it's not so simple. It's not so simple. So you're right. I think that the tikkun has to be more with the left hand than with the right hand. I find that. You need both. You need both. Had an interesting experience. A couple of months ago, I was in Eretz Yisrael talking to some Rosh Yeshiva types about their experience teaching kids who we send them for the year or 2 years or 5 years of learning, whatever it is. And it was very interesting. At some point, they really let their hair down and were really talking. And they said, what's wrong with the American yeshivas? What's wrong with America? The parents don't love their children. We have to give them all the love. That's why we transform them. Why are we so successful? It's because we love them. They're obviously not getting it in America. And I try to respectfully tell them that they have it all wrong. They really have it all wrong. The reason why they're successful, it's not kochi votsam yadi. It's not that simple. The reason they're so successful is because they take kids at a uniquely open period of their life where kids are open to change. The reason they're so successful is because the parents here have the courage to allow the kids to change. The reason why they're so successful is because of the magic alchemy of Torah and Eretz Yisrael, which is real. It may sound corny, but it's real. It's real. We know it. Just have to spend a little bit of time learning in a yeshiva there, and you see it. And the reason why it's so successful is probably maybe a little bit the tougher lifestyle of an Israeli yeshiva. They don't have the maid service that they often have here, our kids, and they don't have maybe the same quality food, and they don't have the same quality accommodations. But there is a little bit that they're looking for the limits. It's a little bit that they're looking for a little bit more of a challenge. But it's not because of lack of love. And I try to explain that to them. I know they bought it, but I try to explain that to them. Because I really believe that our problem, I agree with you, I couldn't agree with you more wholeheartedly. I wish I had an easier answer. The answer, I think, has to lie in the home. In the home, and the limit setting in the home. And you're right, I don't think the main issue is love. I think the main issue is limits. Yes?
What about the happiness factor? I think a lot of parents want their children to be happy, and that's what becomes the focus. You don't want them to be miserable, but I think that, you know, when they say about parents loving children, sometimes wanting them to be happy is so they don't make life hard for me. You know, kids are miserable, or they're not so happy, or they're unhappy about something that happens in school. They come home and they get parents a little bit of trouble. So where does that go in? Like, in other words, how happy do the kids have to be? I mean, I know some people who say, well, I send my kids to such and such school because the kids are happy there. But is it just happy, or you want them to be all happy?
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of a non-linear answer. The answer is about happiness, and it's a very complicated question. But let me try to answer it to the best of my ability. Happiness is not the same as the American view of happiness. American view of happiness is interesting. The word happiness has the same etymology as the word happenstance, luck, something that happens. The average American, what would it take to make you a little happy? They almost all say money. And the research shows no connection at all between money and happiness. Most people think if they win the lottery, they'd be more happy. The research shows the year after winning the lottery, you're much more likely to be depressed than if you didn't win the lottery at all. The real connections clearly have nothing to do with the Western view of what makes people happy. The research shows that what makes people happy, and ultimately will make children happy, is not the English word of happy as happenstance, but the Hebrew word of simcha as shum moach. It's where your head is at. And when your head is connected to the three Fs, okay? Not the F of funds, but the F of family, friends, and faith. This is something some of you have heard me talk about. The research clearly shows this. What is happiness about? It's about connection to what matters. It's connection to the religion. Every day a week that somebody goes to Minyan, they're likely to have a higher level of happiness than if they go a little bit less. people who are connected to friends in a real meaningful way, people who are connected to the community in a way that they pitch in and do chores, kids who are connected to family with the right kind of respect, it's through the limits that happiness comes, not through the freedom. Not through the freedom. So it's not the F of freedom either. It's the connection which in turn connects us to meaning. It's the Shem Moach. It's the Shem Moach. So that's just something to keep in mind in terms of that. Okay. We have more questions. Ask away. Go ahead. Yeah. Then I'll hear from you. Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's. Right. Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So, and everything you said, I agree with completely. And the tough thing about the mental health field is, like, I am Panim LaTorah. There are so many different pathways to the same problem. It's like I was saying before. Depression is in part biochemical vulnerability. So some people are more prone to depression if they have both a certain genetic and biochemical vulnerability. So the same series of events and the same family will lead to one kid getting depressed, the other kid will be fine. And the difference has to do with, you know, certain genetic differences and biologic differences. Okay, so some of it is that. But then there's the factors that you're talking about, which are also very true. If you live a life where you're not connected to anything that gives you anything to look forward to, you're not feeling good about yourself, you're not feeling like you're connected to the community or to the family, and you're feeling alienated, you're much more likely to be depressed. Different families, as again, I've spoken about this a number of times, different families have bumper stickers, and different communities have bumper stickers. So some families, the bumper sticker is like Lakewood or bust. Other families, it's Harvard or die, or Chesed or else, or whatever it is. That's what it takes to really feel part of the family. If you have a temperament that makes it difficult for you to feel like you're really accepted by your family and your community. So let's say you have a temperament that is a little bit harder for you to learn, or a little bit harder for you to have the zitzfleish to sit down and focus and do what it takes to become a hero in your family or your community, you're going to start to feel alienated. And the more alienated you are, the more you're likely to be cut off from the three F's of family, friends, and faith. And then if you're alienated, you're at risk for depression that way. So it's a very complex kind of thing. And that's why there's so much emphasis on the love part. There's so much emphasis on the hug. You have to figure out a way to include kids who may be marching to the beat of a different bumper sticker. Okay? And that's not so easy. What do I find in our community? I find in our community it is tough to be an outlier. It is a pretty demanding community. There isn't that much wiggle room to get out of it. I find that communities that are more flexible, there might be somewhat lower rates of depression. Communities that allow kids to find their way in different flavors and with multiple paths, it's a little bit easier to not be depressed, even if you have that biologic vulnerability. So it's complicated stuff, but what's in our control to do about it is to be more flexible, to be more accepting, both in our educational systems and in the way we open our heart to kids within our families who may be marching to the beat of a different drum. Okay? So it's a very complicated question. I could probably stay here all night going through it. But yeah, everything you pointed out is true. And neither at the, in other words, yes, sometimes it's mainly this, sometimes it's mainly that. You know, there's so many pathways. I once heard a lecture on drug abuse from the head of NIDA, the head of the main government agency in charge of research on drug abuse. And he said something like there are 80 different pathways to substance abuse. And he showed this slide with all the complex ways that the tens of millions of dollars of research has showed could lead to substance abuse. It's not so simple. And all we have to do, all we can do is what it boils down to, is figuring out a way to find that balance. I don't know what else we could do, you know, and to keep our eyes open, to try to identify it early, and to try to deal with it as a community and all that stuff. Yeah?
Okay, I hope I can finish probably, but, you know, we've been there. on that. We go on some emotions. We have a tough love rhythm. And everything's going very good. And we're in this slow, gradual climb towards the good. And then we have this tragedy of the community. And it kind of like really shakes the whole world apart. So now, are the rules the same in the future? Because on one hand, I can see from a deep perspective that it's kind of like, oh, my, until someone attacked Polystyle, no, everyone was afraid to. But once they did it, it kind of made things easier. For the teens, you know, suicide was a very big, scary thought. And I apologize, like, you know, for spending big blunt like this, but it happened now. And it's a reality for many kids. Some may be scaring them all, but for some kids, it's kind of like keeping the eye into, look at the tensions going on, look what's happening, look at all the commotion that's going on here. And now, do we have a new fear? Do we have a new sensitivity? And what's our next step based on this for the kids?
Yeah. Okay. Good question. Maybe what I'll do is I'll end it with this. I'll end because I saw just in terms of questions that it's petering out of London, and then I'll be happy to talk to anybody afterwards privately. You know, just sort of like to. So let me end it because the question was, and I'm going to end it on a positive note with a story, but first with an answer. Suicide is contagious in adolescence. The research shows that there's no other time of life that kids are as likely to be contagious to exposure. So it is a time of crisis. I can't falsely reassure you and say that, don't worry, this is an outlier, this is a very unusual situation. That's probably, hopefully, true. But the reality is like you say, once the you know, the genie is out of the bottle or something, you can't put it back in. It's not easy, because kids do possibly see that, and to the extent that it may be seem a little bit heroic or a little bit idealized, we have to be very careful about that. And it's, you know, again, it's that old Chinese thing that the word for crisis is danger and opportunity. It's a time of danger. It's also a time of opportunity. It's a time to reach out to your kids to name the monster. You know, you name the monster, you talk about it. I have a colleague who is a big expert in trauma. Guy who'd been at Harvard, now he's at BU, a psychiatrist, and he's done all kinds of research, but one of the weirder things he did was he had a friend who's himself a psychiatrist who was in the World Trade Center on 9/11, and he took a picture of his brain using an fMRI where you could see what this man's brain looked like when he was reliving the horrors of that day. And he showed that at that point, as he was having a flashback to that horrible time in 9/11, Broca's area was shut down. The language centers of the brain shut down, meaning he was literally rendered speechless. And part of the ways that we recover from the horrible times of life is we have to light up Broca's area. We have to talk things out. We have to come together. We have to put words to it and perhaps have to reach out to our kids just to make sure, to give them a hug, to make sure that whatever feelings they may have, they could always come to us no matter what. So let me end with this story. It's a story, again, I've said it over, but it's an unbelievable story that goes like this. I was in Eretz Yisrael during the height of the Intifada. And I was giving some lectures there to some trauma therapists. My main area in the secular world is trauma, so I'm asked sometimes to give talks on trauma and to do training in different parts of the world. And I was in Yerushalayim. And I was giving some trainings to the psychiatrists and psychologists there who were in the Jerusalem Trauma Center in Yerushalayim. And as I'm talking, word came in of the bombing of Hebrew University. And 7 people were killed, 5 of them Americans, and they were the phones were ringing off the hook. They couldn't deal with all the calls coming in. Israel's like one big overgrown bungalow colony. So people were coming from all over. The calls were coming, you know, we need your help here, we need your help there. So they turned to me. They say, look, can you go? We can't handle all these calls. There are only so many therapists in a trauma center. Could you go there? They said there was a camp in the middle of Israel that their madricha, their counselor, the head of the program, had just been killed in the bombing. So I jump in a car with an Israeli psychologist, and we find our way to this camp. And as soon as we walk in, they put us in the corner of the room. Right in the corner of the room. And they don't let us take over the way I'm used to doing if there's, God forbid, a tragedy here of major proportions. They tell the kids, you know, about the horrible tragedy, and they say, look, we have five coping rooms, five places where you could work this stuff at. One is a room where you could go and write letters to the parents of your madricha about what a wonderful woman she was. The other is you could express yourself through music, and the other is you could express yourself through art, and the other is you could express yourself through davening. And then there is a room where they could talk to us. And the kids were told they could switch from room to room throughout the day, but no kids switched. The kids divided themselves equally among four of the five rooms. None of them chose the davening room, but the other four rooms they chose. That's a talk in itself why they didn't choose the davening room. But that's my religious development and adolescence talk. It's a fascinating area. But anyway, they chose the four rooms, and the kids, the 20% of the kids who chose the talking room really spoke out, talked it out, okay? And the music kids stayed with the music, the art kids with the art, the writing kids with the writing, 25%. And it went on like that. Okay, come back to America. And I was giving a talk, and the next week, and I tell them about the five coping rooms. I tell the audience, firm audience, it was a 9/11 related talk the next week. And a woman raises her hand in the audience after I tell coping rooms and what I learned from that, that coping comes in different flavors. By the way, nobody could tell you how to cope. The research shows you have to cope. You have to use your style in communicating to your kids. Your kid has to use their style in dealing with stress. You have to respect their right to deal with things. But woman says the following story. She said that her father was a Hasidic guy, and he was in the concentration camp with Elie Wiesel. Okay? And she had been at a lecture given by Mr. Wiesel just the week earlier. And she knew they were in the same bunk. They were adolescents, literally in the same bunk. And she goes over to him and she says, Mr. Wiesel, I don't know if you remember my father, but my father is so-and-so. And he says, do I remember your father? He saved my life. She says, you never told me that. And he proceeded to tell the following story, and with this I'll end. Told the story that there was a horrible, cold, wintry, dark, awful day in the camps, even by concentration camp standards. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison. And they lined up. They decided, look, who needs us? We don't need to live with this pain. They're going to kill us all anyway. Let's just end it ourselves. And the Russians decided to take the rat poison. They were waiting online, patiently waiting their turn to take the poison and end their lives. So Elie Wiesel and his bunkmates, all these teenagers, again, it's a time of life that suicide is contagious, like unfortunately, like you point out. They look at each other and they say, you know something? We have a way out, you know? It's a wonderful solution. Who needs this? And they join the line, waiting, fully intending to take the rat poison when it was their turn. And he turns to her and he says, everybody join the line but your father. Your father, Chassid Shagai, he held on to his faith, even through the horrors of the Holocaust. And he went to the side of the line, and he broke out into this beautiful niggun of Ani Mamin Be'emuna Shlema B'Vias HaMashiach. Right? I believe in ultimate redemption. Beautiful niggun of Ani Mamin. And he said it broke our suicidal spell. And one by one, we left the line. And one by one, we went next to your father and joined him in singing Ani Mamin. Okay? And that's the message I want to leave you with. The message is, look, you're right. We have to keep our eyes open. We can't have halama. We have to keep our ears open. We have to keep our hearts open. We have to be open to all of this. And there's no one right way to do it. There are a lot of different flavors. There are a lot of different ways. There's a whole big toolbox of coping. But the antidote to the alienation that leads to the tragedy that the community just experienced. The antidote lies in each of your families. It lies in each of your hearts. It lies in lighting up Brokaw's area by giving words to things, by talking out, reaching out. And let's just hope that as we enter the Yontif of Shavuos, and as we go from Chayrus to Chorus, right, we go from the meaning of freedom, which is the freedom as Pesach is all about, which is the freedom to spend our time as we wish, as slaves can't, and the freedom to be with our children and raise them the way we want. We have to balance the freedom of Chayrus, which is the right hand of the love, with the chorus, right? With the limits, with the chorus, with what's on the luchos, right? With Torah, with limits. And that balance between chorus and chorus, as we draw closer to the holiday of chorus, let's just hope that that message is something that we can now take to all of our children. So thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.